Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, welcome to The Rest is History. It is the 4th of January, and we are ploughing through the 12 days of Christmas. As you can probably tell, the sheer pressure of recording all these 12 days of Christmas podcasts has led to me partially losing my voice. But that's fine, because Tom Holland loves to talk.
No, but my voice is going as well.
Oh no, Tom, the jeopardy.
It's a kind of sexy husk.
Well, yes. Yeah. Like Margaret Thatcher's voice. Is that what
Yes, you're... very, very like that.
Very like Mrs. Thatcher.
Going very, 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 very rough voice.
Tom, I think you've been doing splendidly. You've been doing wonderfully well.
Thank
We're
you.
Very pleased with you.
Thank you.
Would you give us, please, your event that happened on this day in history and make it a good one, Tom?
Yeah, so today is, it's the day that Solomon Northrop regained his freedom, January the 4th, 1853. And Solomon Northrop will be familiar to anyone who has seen Steve McQueen's Oscar-winning film, 12 Years a Slave. So this is the terrible story of a black man born in New York State, freeborn. He's a farmer. He was also a very proficient violinist. And this was the key to what then happens. He's played by Chiwetel Ejiofor in the film. And Solomon Northrup, his mother is a freeborn woman. His father is a freed slave. There's absolutely no question about the fact, you know, he's not in any way a slave. He's completely a free man. He marries, a woman called Anne Hampton, who's a kind of mix of black, white, Native American. She's a cook. So they're kind of lower class, but they're not on the breadline at all.
Right.
They're very happily married. And in 1841, because as I mentioned, he has this proficiency at the violin, he's offered as a job as a musician in Washington, D.C. And Washington, D.C., of course, is that much further south than New York. And so therefore, closer to the line where slaves legal.
They have big slave markets, I think, in Washington, don't they?
And basically, it turns out that the people who've offered Solomon Northrop this job they're crooks. Mm-hmm. And that they've ordered him because they want to sell him as a slave. So they get him to Washington, D.C. under this false prospectus. They drug him. They kidnap him. They sell him. And he gets shipped to New Orleans. And you can imagine, it's just, I mean, the most terrible thing to happen. And in New Orleans, he is bought by Benedict Cumberbatch.
Right.
So William Prince Ford, who is a Baptist minister.
Yeah.
And Baptists generally, you know, certainly in the North, they're very kind of abolitionists. They're very much at the kind of the front line of opposing slavery. And Ford is a troubled slave owner, I think it would be fair to say. And in due course, when Northrop writes up his memoirs, 12 Years a Slave, he writes of William Ford, in my opinion, there never was a more kind, noble, candid Christian man than William Ford. The influences and associations that had always surrounded him blinded him to the inherent wrong at the bottom of the system of slavery. It's kind of, from our perspective, an amazing couple of sentences for someone to write.
Kind of gracious,
yeah, but I mean, I think it brings home just how radical an upheaval the assumptions that come to underpin abolitionism are.
Mm-hmm.
People had taken the institution of slavery for granted for so long that it was perfectly possible to accept that a man could be a kind, noble, candid Christian man and still think that slavery was fine.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge theme that I think we're going to do an episode on slavery at some point. And it won't surprise you to know that I do think that the wellsprings of abolitionism are deeply Christian.
Oh,
and
that's, Tom, I don't think you're alone in that way. I mean, that's hardly, of all your views, that's probably the least controversial.
No, but obviously Christian arguments are also used to justify slavery.
Yeah.
And so this figure, this Baptist minister is kind of an interesting figure for that reason.
Yeah.
So what then happens is that Ford gets into financial difficulties. And so he sells Northrop on to this carpenter called John Thibault, who is, he's a wanker. Am I allowed to say? I used that word, didn't
I? Is that the guy who stole the turkey, the turkey out of your car?
I think he's probably even worse than that. Even worse than that. And Thibault is, I mean, he's an absolute brute. He almost lynches Northrop.
Well, they have a fight or something, don't they?
They have a fight, yeah. And but Ford comes, cuts Northrop down. So he's kind of playing the good guy there. And then Thibault sells him on to a plantation owner called Edwin Epps. And in the film, he's played by Michael Fassbender.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Michael Fassbender always plays the kind of character you don't want to be sold to as a slave.
Yeah. But he played Macbeth, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, he did. And he played Magneto, I think, in the X-Men.
Yeah. I know you're a big superheroes fan, Tom.
Well, so those are the ones that I liked. Those are the ones I saw.
Right.
So Michael Fassbender plays the young... Who plays the older one?
The old Magneto. Is it Ian McKellen or Patrick
Stewart? Ian McKellen. That's right. So anyway, so he... This poor guy, Solomon Northrop, he has to work as a slave in Louisiana and 12 years a slave. And there he is, toiling away. 12 years in, he meets a Canadian who's working on the plantation, a guy called Samuel Bass. And Samuel Bass gets word back to New York.
Bass is an abolitionist, is that right?
Yes. And it's a brave thing for him to do because he's breaking Southern law by doing that.
Right.
Louisiana law. But in New York, the law of the state provides aid to free New York citizens who've been kidnapped and enslaved. So it's obviously a kind of massive thing that's going on. I mean, it's happening so often that there are state provisions to combat it. And so Northrop's family and his wife, Anne Hampton, has stayed true to him. Solomon Northrop has stayed true in his love to Anne. That's kind of very touching story. Northrop's family and friends, they enlist the aid of the governor of New York, a guy called Washington Hunt, and Northrop gains his freedom on this day in 1853. And his kidnappers, nothing happens to them. They never get punished. They never get caught.
Quite hard to track them down, I suppose.
Yeah. Later in the year, he gets encouraged to write up the story of what's happened.
Yeah.
And so 12 Years a Slave, it becomes very significant text in the abolitionist cause. And Northrop, he does quite a lot of campaigning on it. And then he just kind of fades from the record.
And do we know what happened to him?
Not really, no.
But I suppose the book is his memorial, isn't it? The book and the film, because the book is one of those film, slave definitely. Narratives that those sort of narratives play a huge part in kind of rousing the hearts and souls of kind of Northern opinion in the years before the Civil War, don't they? Uncle Tom's Cabin type. I mean, Uncle Tom's Cabin is obviously slightly different, but those sort of stories of fugitive slaves and sort of the horrors and the sort of the injustice of it. They bring home probably more than any number of tracts, non-political, kind of unaffiliated people, just the horror of the institution, don't you think?
Well, I think also the particular impact of this is, obviously most of the narratives, the abolitionist narratives, are for white abolitionists, particularly in the North.
Yeah.
It's essentially saying, pity the poor black people, the poor black slaves. But they're still, it's very, very difficult for white people in the North to imagine themselves as black slaves.
Yeah.
But the power of this is that because Solomon Northrop was a free man in a Northern state, it therefore becomes much easier for white people in the North to put themselves into his shoes. And I think that's the power of it. Because the shock for Northrop isn't that he's been born into slavery or he's been brought from Africa to slavery. He's someone who is born free, who's lived free, and who then becomes a slave.
Yeah.
And I think that, kind of emotionally, perhaps, for white readers in the northern states, it makes the horror of what happened to him all the greater.
That's a good story. It's a fascinating story. It reminds me a tiny. I mean, I'll tell you a narrative from a century later that has always stuck in my mind. You may not have read it. It's a book called Black Like Me by John Howard Griffin. Have you ever read that?
No, I haven't.
So this is again a book very powerful with white audiences, but the difference here is it's not that Griffin was free and became a slave. It was white, and then he literally blacked up. So he decided, so it's the sort of in the middle of the civil rights movement. And he,
I think it was the 50s.
59. He decides, he goes to a doctor friend and a dermatologist. And he says, basically, make me black. And they give him drugs. And he has hours and hours every day under a lamp to sort of darken his skin. And then he puts on a stain on top of it. And then he basically spends, I think, something like 6 weeks, maybe longer. Traveling through the South and describing as a white man what it's like,
to be black. Treated as a black man.
Yeah. And again, it's the kind of story that actually, because he's not black, because he's white, that kind of gives him an in with readers who might have just dismissed the book and not, you know. And he just sort of talks about what an eye-opening.
So there is a massive change in how he's treated.
Yeah, colossal. Yeah, of course. Well, he's literally sitting in a different part of the bus, and
course,
if he
yeah.
and instinctively, you know, he'll go to the sort of white seats counters and things like that, and people glare at him, and he realizes, you know, he could be. It's not implausible that he could be killed for being in the wrong place at the wrong time, the wrong look at the wrong woman, all that kind of thing. So that's a very unjolly reading recommendation for the new year.
Yeah.
I mean, 12 Years a Slave. Have you read it, Tom?
Or
have you
just seen haven't the film? Read it. I've seen the film.
Yeah.
I haven't read the book. But I quite feel quite inspired by doing, you know, thinking about this to go and read it.
Well, it's obviously a harrowing read.
Yeah.
I mean, unbelievably sort of harrowing story, isn't it? To go from, you know, you think you're off to play in a violin in a circus and you end up being beaten on a plantation. Anyway, rather depressing subject.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No, but it's
but it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, you know, 12 Days of Christmas, ho ho ho, jollity jollity. But
yeah,
I mean, basically, things are memorable in history often for terrible reasons.
They are, aren't they?
So we've had murders and coups and enslavement and all kinds of horrors.
Yeah.
More fun and jollity after the break.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome back to The Rest of History, the 4th of January. And Dominic, you're going to cheer us up by giving your choice for something that happened on this day.
So it is the 4th of January, we're in 1960. Albert Camus, the French writer, has just been spending New Year in the south of France at his home in the Vaucluse in a village called Lomarin, which I've been to, a very pretty sort of Provençal kind of village. Because Tom, did you know that I spent a year living in Provence?
I did.
Peter Mayle style.
Yes, I did.
I was teaching. Yeah. I was awful. I was totally out of my depth.
You were wonderful.
No, I was terrible. Because they gave you
introducing les étudiants.
It was awful, Tom. My French was
British
so...
British bacon and eggs. And...
So I'd sort of thought, oh, I'm terribly good at French. This will be an absolute triumph. And I arrived in France at the age of 21. And I remember going to try and open my bank account so that I could receive my minimum wage from the French government. And I stood there in front of this bank manager and I realized I didn't know how to say, I'd like to open a bank account. Yeah, because all I'd done is, you know, I've been doing French literature. So I knew how to say... What do you think about
Madame Bovary?
Madame Bovary.
Unhappy.
Yeah, but I was utterly out of my depth. I can remember some people, the students used to say to me, "You speak quite good French, but why do you speak it with that ludicrous comic English accent?" Which I found very insulting. Anyway, so Lourmarin, its claim to fame is that this was the home of the writer Albert Camus. And Camus, of course, is the sort of, he's a little bit, I don't want to damn him, he's the teenager's favourite, isn't he?
Yeah, he looks very cool with a cigarette.
He looks terribly cool with a cigarette. His book's about existentialism and so on.
Although he never defined himself as an existentialist, did he?
No, he didn't.
He was an absurdist.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, you know what, particularly when the pandemic hit, lots of people went back to their copies of La Peste, the plague, and they said, oh gosh, this is actually, you know, so it's a really, really good book. And the fact that you read it when you were 18 and you thought it changed your, I mean, that's no reason to sort of curl your lip at it.
Yeah, I feel a bit the same about Nietzsche, to be honest.
Really?
I was absolutely mad for Nietzsche when I was 18. And then I kind of thought, oh, I've grown out of that.
Yeah.
And now I just felt he's brilliant.
Yeah.
So maybe I think about Camus as well.
That's sort of what I think about Camus, actually. Because Camus was, I think, genuinely a very impressive man, much more impressive than Jean-Paul Sartre, who's a terrible man by comparison.
Yeah.
So Camus,
I'm happy to accept that.
He's born in Algeria, and he wrestles all his life with the fact that he's the product of a kind of French pied-noir settler family in Algeria. And
so he was neutral in the Algerian War, wasn't he?
He was, and you can absolutely understand why. A lot of his sort of lefty friends in France sort of thought terribly badly of him and disavowed him for this. But his attitude was, which was sort of understandable. I mean, he had this famous line, I love justice, but I love my mother more, which was shocking to the kind of Sartrean tendency, because they thought abstract nouns were far more important than people.
Yes, it's kind of like, I hope I would have the courage to betray my country over my friend.
Exactly.
Reversed.
So Camus, he has been on this kind of intellectual journey. So round about the Second World War, just after the war,
and he has a good war, doesn't he? I mean, he has a really good war. So he edits Combat.
Exactly.
Which is a kind of resistance magazine. I mean, he's incredibly brave.
He's one of the sort of intellectual heroes of the resistance. Yeah. And afterwards, like so many people in that milieu, he's this young, very sort of suave, but obviously Algerian. So he's got a bit of an outsider side to him.
Very good footballer. Goalkeeper, wasn't he?
Goalkeeper, yeah. Where he played at university in Algiers,
and he could have been really good, couldn't he? He got
that's what people
some
say.
Disease or something.
Yeah, you never know though whether these things are slightly exaggerated later because he's
like John Paul II.
Yeah, exactly, John Paul II, who almost played in goal for Real Madrid or something, if you believe some accounts. But actually, probably just played, you know, goal twice or something. Anyway, Camus, he's always a bit of an outsider. He never quite fits in. And there's this period in the sort of late 40s where basically if you're a left-bank intellectual, you're very self-consciously left-wing. You
know, and pro-Stalin.
Pro-Stalin. Camus, some people say he's a bit more of an anarchist than a communist, but certainly by the 50s, he is moving. He's moving quite strongly in some ways to the centre. You know, he's saying things like, you know, revolutionary violence is not a good thing.
So he's kind of the French George Orwell.
Yeah, he is exactly. I mean, there's lots of differences, so it's not an exact parallel. But you're absolutely right that he occupies that place.
Yeah.
of being the sort of left-wing with a tremendous backstory like Orwell.
Very opposed to Stalinism.
Very opposed to Stalinism and increasingly sort of interested in human detail, I suppose, and the texture of human people, ordinary people's lives, rather than grand ideological schemes.
Abstractions.
Yeah. So he's been given the Nobel Prize, which people see as, they see that as a Cold War thing. You know, they're as almost encouraging him to back towards the centre. It is a bit of a slap in the face.
Well, because you know the only person younger than him to get the Nobel Prize.
Oh, that's a good one. I knew he was one of the youngest.
He was second youngest. Kipling.
I was about to say Kipling. So Kipling, Kipling must have got it very early then.
Kipling got it really early, yeah. But then Camus, the second youngest.
Two top writers. I'm very pleased to see them. I don't imagine they'd have got on, though, do you?
No.
Kipling, Camus?
No. Kipling would have had no time for Camus.
Though, all that sort of smoking and lounging around in cafes. Kipling would have been off on, you know, doing bushcraft or something.
Yes.
Anyway, so Camus, he's not terribly happy, I think, at the end of the 1950s, although he's got his Nobel Prize. For some people in this sort of old intellectual establishment, he's a bit persona non grata. So he's been down at his house in the South for New Year with his family and with his publisher, who's a man called Michel Gallimard, and Gallimard's wife and daughter. And they decide they're going to go back to Paris. So on the 2nd of January, Camus' wife and children go off back to Paris by train, and Gallimard says to Camus, well, I'll give you a lift if you stay another couple of days, and I'll give you a lift in my very fancy car. Camus, yeah, tremendous. So on the 4th of January, they set off, and basically no one really knows what happens, but they're not that far from Paris when the car goes off the road and hits a plane tree, and Gallimard's wife and daughter escape unscathed. Camus is killed instantaneously, and Gallimard dies a few days later. So, and in the car is the 144-page manuscript of what Camus has written so far, which he the novel that he thinks will be his masterpiece, which is called Le Premier Homme, The First Man. And this is going to be his first really autobiographical novel about growing up in Algeria. So a very profound kind of subject, given that the Franco-Algerian War is absolutely in full swing. And he's going to be writing quite lyrically about the experience of growing up in Algeria. And of course, that book is never finished, isn't published until, I think, something like 30 years later. Camus was killed. And at the time, lots of people say it must be a conspiracy. He must have been murdered by the KGB because of his move back towards the kind of political centre. But almost certainly that's not the case. It's just sort of Gallimard's bad driving or whatever. I mean, who knows?
Not Prince Philip.
No. Well, Prince Philip obviously has form with Gallic car crashes. Yes. But in this case, no, he wasn't involved at all, as far as I know.
So I studied for French at school, a play by Camus called Les Justes.
Oh, yeah. I remember about, Les Justes.
Revolutionaries, Russian revolutionaries.
Yes.
And the plot of that, they have to blow up a Russian prince or something in a car.
That's it. Yeah.
In a carriage. So kind of death on roads is an eerie prefiguring.
And he wrote a play about Caligula.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
Which I can remember doing at A-level. And it ends, Caligula is killed, and the last line is, he shouts, I'm still alive, as he's being killed, and then the play ends. Very profound. I have to say, I find all those 50s French plays, which I studied a lot, I find them terrible.
And indeed acted in.
Yeah, well, the Jean Anouilh. I mean, yeah. I'm always happy to mention that on the...
Yeah.
I think the listeners have probably heard enough about that for the time being. But I think they're just... So all those Sartre plays, Les Mains Sales and stuff, Dirty Hands, they're basically people just standing and talking to each other endlessly. What is violence? You know, all this... They're dramatically, yeah, utterly inert, I think. But I think Camus' novels... And he wrote a
and the myth of Sisyphus.
Yes.
One must think that Sisyphus is happy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a kind of memorable tagline.
Yeah, it's a good image. I mean, that's his sort of statement of the absurd, isn't it? He also wrote some very interesting short stories called Exile in the Kingdom. A lot of them set in Algeria, which are kind of quite weird. And they've been attacked by critics as a bit orientalizing.
Right.
But that's kind of inevitable, I suppose, if you're growing up as part of that sort of settler community surrounded by, you know, North African Muslims. You know what? The very first piece of research I ever did, Tom, was on French colonial Algeria.
Yes, you've mentioned this. You have mentioned this.
A pogrom in the city of Constantine in 1934.
And, well, we're going to do it. We're going to do the Algerian War.
That'd be a great subject. It's a really fascinating. And, of course, people who came to our live show will know we are great fans of the Battle of Algiers.
So lots to look forward to on that front.
We've got more Gallic conduct tomorrow, actually.
Yes, we have, yes.
In a stunning rebuke for people who've sometimes said there's not enough French history on this podcast, we're absolutely wallowing in French history.
Yeah, we've actually got two French-themed topics tomorrow, but we mustn't reveal what they are. We must keep the tension cranked up. But tomorrow is obviously the most important day of the year, 5th of January, because it's my birthday.
Tom Holland's birthday. What a great moment. Yeah. So, of course, it's not. You get two birthdays, don't you? You're like the Queen, because you have your real birthday and then you have your official Twitter birthday where people, teenagers in America.
Yes, probably.
Send you.
Tell them they want to marry me, which is lovely. You know, though Sadie doesn't really, always comes as a shock to her when she finds it.
What are all these messages?
22-year-old in Rio de Janeiro is offering herself to me. I just bluntly say no. None of that nonsense.
Yeah. Right. We'll see you tomorrow. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.